Fountain is a women's theater located in Minneapolis, Minnesota, where for several months the focus of the theater's work has been the world of prostitution. I'm Susan DeLatra, a member of the theater, and with me are four guests, along with playwright Martha Roth and director Martha Bosing. During our discussion, you'll be hearing excerpts from the play, recreated by the original At the Foot of the Mountain cast. I'd like to introduce our guests. Delmarie Drake, formerly involved in prostitution herself, is one of the founders of Pride, a self-help group committed to effecting change in prostitution. Sarah Evans is a social historian at the University of Minnesota. Mimi Golke, also at the university, teaches English literature. And Janet Spector, an anthropologist, is also on the university faculty. Martha Roth, I'd like to ask you, what were the issues that originally impelled you to write a play about prostitution and women's sexuality?
I'm a writer by trade, and I was on an extended assignment a year ago, which involved my living alone in New York City for a while. And I'd never lived alone before, and in the course of the year, living alone in big city, Tinseltown, I discovered some things about myself as a woman living alone that my social definition as a woman was a peculiar one, was one that I wasn't used to dealing with as a wife and mother. My availability as a sexual object, simply by virtue of my being a woman living alone, was somewhere along a scale that included teenage hookers in Times Square, expensive call girls on the East Side, actresses and models, people's mistresses, rich men's wives, working women, lots of women who make accommodations with the male power structure using their sexuality for economic gain. And it became clearer to me that my extra writerly behavior was feeding into social stereotypes of women, sexual availability, by putting on a certain costume in the morning and doing certain things to my face and hair. I was collaborating in a way that I didn't understand and still don't fully with men's illusions about women's sexuality being for sale.
The legs must be shaved. The nails of the feet must be trimmed and painted. After they have been prepared, the feet are put into shoes with heels so high that the spine bends here, emphasizing the fleshy protuberances. Big tits are good. Sexy, funny. Big ass is good. Big belly is bad. It looks like a pregnancy, and pregnancy is ugly. The function of the underwear is to mold her, pushing up, rounding, pressing down. She is supposed to look as if she were bursting out of it, overflowing like an overstuffed fowl. The armpits must be freed of hair. The hands which dangle at the ends of the arms must be decorated. The fingers softened, weighed down with rings. She is supposed to look delicious, expensive, delicate, like fancy pastry or a china figurine. The naked face must not be seen. The eyes must appear hollow with lust. She must heighten the color of her cheeks as though her blood were pounding with desire. The lips appear swollen, glistening with saliva. Now she is acceptable. Now she can go to work.
Well, Martha Bosing, director now of this production of The Life, tell me, why would a feminist theater collective want to do a play about prostitution?
Well, as a matter of fact, we didn't. We as a theater collective have chosen to organize ourselves pretty much outside of the mainstream. We certainly are our own bosses. We don't have any men over us. We have no hierarchy within our own collective. And felt somehow that we had cleaned ourselves out of these issues. We didn't have to deal with them. We were not prostitutes. In any definition, in anybody's definition of the word, we really had found a way to live outside of that in a real woman-defined world. But we had said to Martha, you choose the subject. So we said, okay, we'll work with prostitution. It didn't take very long before we discovered what baloney all that was. That, of course, the issue was very close to us, that, of course, we continued to prostitute ourselves in many ways in our own lives. And and our own sexuality, which became the subject of the play, finally, not the issue of prostitution was no longer the issue. The issue was women's sexuality, our sexuality, how we've been abused. And it became very painful and true.
Well, it strikes me that the development of the play itself shows how the issues changed for the theater, as you've said, Martha. Hillary, the feminist lawyer in the play, gives the opening speech, which is an impassioned argument for the decriminalization of prostitution.
Good evening. It's wonderful to see all of you here. Thank you for coming out on this beautiful evening to support an X-rated cause. I'm Hillary Gordon, and as many of you know, I'm a lawyer. Our program this evening is a dramatic argument for the decriminalization of prostitution. Now, when we argue for the decriminalization of prostitution, all we're talking about is the sale of sexual services between consenting adults, and I don't mean juveniles. The crime of an adult prostitute is a crime without a victim. What she sells is not unlawful. The acts that she and her clients perform are protected by constitutional guarantees of privacy. Only the sale is unlawful. In other words, she can give it away, but she can't sell it. Do you know of any other service that's legal when it's free and a crime when it's sold? It's ridiculous. And what's more than ridiculous is that only the prostitute is punished for this so-called crime. In theory, the customer is equally guilty, but in practice, it's the prostitute that's arrested, imprisoned, and fined. The selective enforcement discriminates against women in violation of the Constitution of the United States of America, making decriminalization a concern for all of us, women and men.
But later, Hillary's daughter Meredith confronts her mother in a way which shows that what is at stake is not the illegality of prostitution at all.
Hillary, we can't leave them in there.
They're not my daughter. You are.
They are. Do you know why they're in jail?
Meredith, you're beside yourself. Come home. Get some rest. We'll see about getting you some help tomorrow. Calm down.
They're in jail for their sex, Hillary. And it's just an accident. All women aren't in jail.
It's no accident. They're prostitutes. Calm down.
Every woman is an outlaw, Hillary. You don't understand. See, decriminalization is an emergency measure. It's like trying to staple shut a broken dam. Their crime is their sex, Hillary. That's our crime. It's our sex. You think you've escaped it because you're a big lawyer. Boss Lady Sweetcakes calls you. You think you're legal, a legal woman. Well, you're wrong, Hillary. You whore for the men with the power.
Meredith, that's the way of the world. You compromise, you get along. That's politics. Nobody controls their own life.
You're not free sexually either, Hillary. You've been ripped off just like they have, only you take it in the other direction. You turn it off.
Meredith,
don't you?
Well, I've had to give up certain things. We all do. It's a trade-off. You make your choices.
Don't you?
Yes.
Well, I want my body, Hillary. And I want my sexuality. I want to be a whole person.
It was painful to discover that in deciding to become woman-oriented, deciding to separate yourself from the male world and become asexual when you walk out the street or go down into a restaurant or celibate to the world in some way is still a form of sexual abuse. It was just painful to know that that kind of turning off, that kind of coldness and shutdown is another form of, it's a reactive form to the issue of prostitution, but therefore it's still within the issue, within the problem. And several of us discovered that what we had done was sublimate that sexual energy. Some of us had become angry radicals, gone around screaming at the world, but that it still had its source in our own sexuality, our own sexual energy, and how we had coped with it in a world that demanded that we prostitute ourselves.
Well, as we look at our own training and our own response to the culture in which we've grown, I'd like to draw both Sarah Evans and Janet Spector into a discussion of how we can make sense of the attitudes and values which our culture has given us. Sarah, as an historian, can you give us some perspective on the past development of our attitudes toward women's sexuality?
It does seem to me interesting that, in light of what's been said, that prostitution appeared in the North American colonies in the beginnings of the United States in cities at the time when female sexuality was being redefined and male sexuality was being redefined. Towards the Victorian definitions of women, that meaning primarily upper class women, but women as having little or no sexuality, being utterly defined by their bodies as female, but having no expressive sexuality. And so you then get reenacted there, as I suspect has happened in many cultures at many times, that ancient dichotomy of the virgin and the whore. And so some women essentially are deprived of their sexuality, while others are expected to be available to any man who will pay. And that happens also at the same time that a growing number of women are sort of cast out from any supportive structures. Widows, divorced women, women who are poor, who also have a problem in a society that doesn't offer women many ways of supporting themselves.
Let me come at it from another direction, not historically, but cross-culturally, because it seems to me the issue of female sexuality becomes the sort of primary symbol or expression of the subordination of women. That in asymmetrical societies, that is, where women are subordinated, you begin to see it expressed in either the constriction of options in terms of female sexuality. You can think of societies where women either are virgins when they're married or they're killed. That's the option. Or adulterous behavior is met with killing. And women who don't conform to those sexual images then either are defined as nymphomaniacs, not necessarily prostitutes. I think prostitutes come along with class and cash and a lot of professionalization, labor specialization. But in societies that I have looked at, which are asymmetrical but don't have something like prostitution, there's still this sort of symbolization of female subordination in terms of a lot of prescriptions about female sexuality that are not defined by females. A lot of myths about what a proper woman is supposed to be, mm-hmm. sort of like TV advertising.
Plates washed in joy.
What a nice reflection on you.
Between Monday and Friday, I gained 3 beautiful inches on my bust. Only Mark Eden produces rapid and dramatic improvement in the actual bosom.
Who's Meredith's grandmother? And who's her mother? They both have such young-looking hands, it's hard to tell. They both do lots of dishes, too, with ivory liquid.
Now you can remove embarrassing hair from legs and arms. Feel confident. Get as close to him as you want. Nair leaves your skin feeling smooth and touchable.
To kill germs and odors, I use Lysol spray every day.
Del Marie, I'd like to draw you into this discussion. I know that right now your work is with young women. You've seen the play and you've been working with us on it, and we've gotten some perspective now on how prostitution may grow along with urbanization. Is it really true, do you think, that prostitution is the world's oldest profession?
I don't believe it's a profession. I don't think it's ever been a profession. I think men have labeled it, and society labeled it a profession because it serves man. Mm. You know, it serves society. It has served. The thought of going to a woman who may be in a self-destructive behavior, and that's how I label prostitution, it's difficult for a man to deal with the reality of it. So he decides that woman is choosing to get paid $2 or $10 or $200, depending upon his status. And then he places her at a certain status level, equal to him, by calling her a professional. And then he feels more comfortable.
He can trust himself, his needs, mm-hmm. to her services.
Yeah. Part of what the message I was getting from Martha's play is that prostitution is a symbol of the constriction of female mobility, economic mobility, social mobility. That it's sort of one of the few money-making enterprises women can go into. I'm throwing this out.
I know you guys.
Try it out on you. But I'm thinking of it more as a rhetorical statement, not as a statement of fact. That if you think of it as a profession in that way, it speaks to real limitations of women in American society.
Well, it's probably then the only profession where you get paid $300 a night and give it away. And I don't know any other profession who would ever do that professional. You know, you don't keep anything you get. You don't feel anything. There's very little gratification sexually.
Yeah, I don't mean as a positive profession. I don't mean using profession in a positive sense.
I guess my definition of a professional is somebody who's been trained. And then we all become professionals as women from the day we're born, mm-hmm. that we are trained.
You're going to meet the parents? They're going to drop us off. Oh, I want you to make a good impression. Oh, Mother, Dr. Franklin is chief of staff at the hospital. They're very prominent people.
It's just a dance.
Honey, it's your junior prom. Thank God you've got good skin. You ever kiss this boy?
Just a goodnight kiss last time we went out.
I don't want you to sell yourself cheap. And don't let him hold you too close when you dance, either.
I don't even like him that way.
He's going off to college in a year. You don't want some sorority girl to get him.
Yeah, she can have him.
No, hon, you can have him if you play your cards right. You're a beautiful girl. Now, don't waste it.
Ma, he's just a kid. He's got sweaty palms.
Listen, the last time you kiss him tonight, give him just the teensy tip of your tongue.
I refuse to buy that anymore.
Yeah, it seems to me that this also points to our ongoing discussion about what ways are all women the same and in what ways are there fundamental differences that must be recognized. And one of the problems with talking about prostitution as a profession, I think, is that it, while it points out a shared condition, it obscures some fundamental differences and the real horror of prostitution. Mm-hmm. By sort of saying, oh, but we all are.
Yeah. It is hard for some of us to imagine the abuse that some of these women live with, and they have no protection from violence, nowhere to turn if they are prostitutes. Decriminalization would at the very least allow them recourse from sadistic behavior, possibly prevent them from inflicting violence upon their own children, breaking the cycle of abuse that imprisons generations of women. Sweet cakes?
When my ma got pregnant with me, she was only 14. My dad, he was 15. They had to quit school and get married. She didn't want to, but her mom made her, and he didn't want to either because he had to get a job. He didn't stay around real long after I was born. Only came back once that I remember. He bought us ice cream. My sister Candace, Candy we called her, she was born the year after me when Ma was 15, right before our dad took off. And then Ma, she went on AFDC, but she'd do some waitressing sometimes when we lived someplace where someone could take care of us. Then Scott moved in. I was about 4. Candy was 3. He sure was mean. I mean, Ma used to hit us sometimes, but Scott, he had this belt with a big buckle on it, and he used to like to raise welts on us with that. He'd hit Ma, too, a lot. Like, they'd be drinking and laughing and stuff, and he'd call her bitch and push her around. And me and Candy, we'd hide under the bed. And then my Ma got pregnant, had my half-brother, Darren, and there's something wrong with Darren's brain, and Ma said it was from Scott hitting him all the time when he was little. Scott broke my arm once when I was 6, and they took me to the hospital and told the nurse I fell off a chair. Anyway,
isn't that awful?
Darren.
I can assure you that my childhood was completely different.
But he's real strong.
There were no raised voices in our household, no violence. My father never laid a finger on me.
He used to get teased.
Never touched me, as a matter of fact.
Then he'd beat.
Neither did my mother. When I was an infant,
I didn't like
she used to carry me around on a pillow because she was afraid I might break.
I'd never let anybody treat me like that. Anybody tried, I'd kill him.
Like on Saturdays.
I'd never let any man hit my kids.
Gum and candy for us. He used to do these weird things like carve initials into his skin, and once he sewed his fingers together, then I was living with his other
my
guy.
Old man, he had this it's wire around my neck. He was choking me and choking me, and I passed out. And when I came to, he was kissing me and crying and saying how sorry
sometimes
he was,
he'd whip me with those
and
guns
my throat hurt like hell.
I
couldn't even talk.
Wrong at all.
But I started crying too, and that made it worse.
Crazy, so
he was moaning and mumbling about how much he loved me, and he couldn't live without me. And I started comforting him.
So alone. When you're a prostitute.
Yeah.
And
that
you
was
need
clear.
So much. And you can't go to a man at the beginning. My God, you can't. You have to have the women who say you're all right and start caring for you and supporting you as a human being. And if we can swing it around in our society, that I can stand up and say, yes, I was a prostitute, without having to fear being rejected, and somebody in our society saying the behavior of prostitution instead of the profession. Mm-hmm. It is a behavior.
Hello, Shay Sharon. Oh, hello, Carl. Oh, fine, thanks, darling. What can I do for you, as if I didn't know? This afternoon? Well, I'm a little tight, sweetie. That's right, juicy, too. Oh, Carl, you're so impetuous. No, I can't. But listen, I have a new colleague. Yes, there's a new face at Shay Sharon. Oh, yes, that's new, too. She's green. It'll be 200. Well, since I've been telling her so much about you, she's just dying to meet you, and since I can't... Okay, I'll put her on. Here's your first job. You get 50.
But I don't know what to say.
Sure you do. It's a man. It's a date. Go on.
Hello? My name? My name's...
Connie.
Kitty.
Jackie.
Sylvia.
Donna.
My name's Marie. This afternoon? I think that would be okay. Just a second, let me check. Am I doing okay?
Perfect. I told you, it's simple.
Hello, Carl? May I call you Carl? Good. Yes, this afternoon would be fine. About 3? Uh-huh, I'll get the address from Sharon. What? Oh, so am I. Till 3, then. Bye.
Honey, you handled that call like a born hooker.
Hillary, however, in spite of her willingness to defend prostitutes and to work for decriminalization, reveals in herself a deep-seated rejection of the prostitute when Sharon tells Hillary she has had a visit from Meredith. The same kind of rejection, by the way, which Del Marie has told us she does not think decriminalization will solve.
Oh, she's giving you a hard time.
Oh, she's 18, you know. A little rebellion is normal. Now, where's my goddamn schedule? And where do we take this dog and pony show next?
She came to see me, you know.
Oh? What did she say? Is that it? No, damn it. I must be really rattled. I never lose things.
She was interested in details and so impressed.
Impressed.
By the money.
I suppose.
Hillary, don't you know why?
No, I have no idea.
She wants to try it out.
What, prostitution? Mm-hmm. That's absurd, Sharon. She wasn't raised that way.
What way?
What, to think of herself as a marketable commodity?
Oh, Hillary, everyone is.
That's nonsense, Sharon, and I don't want to discuss it any further. Meredith's upset. More upset than I've realized. I've been so busy with this decrim thing,
She wants to do it. Anyway, she's already had her first date.
She's had her first what?
Kind of neat, don't you think? The way it all stays in the family.
That's a perverted joke, Sharon, and I don't think it's funny.
Oh, come on. You just got through telling these people what an honorable trade this is.
Yes, I have. I want something different for her.
I knew it, Hillary. You're just like all the rest of them.
I am not.
You are, you straight bitch. You're prejudiced. You're a hypocrite. You think we're all garbage.
I do not. I go to the net for you all the time.
Oh, you don't do me any favors, Ms. Pickle-up-your-ass. I pay you plenty.
I put my reputation on the line for you. You insult me and you turn out my daughter.
Oh, just don't come on righteous with me, you dried up. You're the pimp.
Let's just forget it, shall we?
I think that is what the play does and does well, is force the audience to confront the reality that most of them have never allowed themselves to think about directly, to imagine themselves having any connection with. It presents that. It also makes clear that decriminalization is no answer. What I found a little confusing was I didn't know what then. You know, what... Okay, decriminalization isn't the answer. This play has made me know that. The life of a prostitute is a destructive, self-destructive life. We all have a lot of parallels to that in our own lives. There was something incredibly powerful about the way the play ended, with the sounds and the dancing, and the women symbolically removing shoes or jewelry or something and leaving. But I didn't quite know what it was It was just incredibly powerful. But I couldn't see clearly where the solution was.
Sarah, I'd like to respond to that because, you see, symbolically the leaving was something, but for me, there was an answer right there at the end of the play when there was the embracing.
Yes.
The loving and the caring. And as simple as that answer is for everything in this world, it's when people start caring for that other human being. Mm-hmm. And that was where I broke down in the play. Mm-hmm. Because it's so damn simple. If all we need to do is start caring for that other human being and, you know, and caring for ourselves and realizing that isn't some entity out there that likes what she's doing, but if you have some love for that person.
I identify, however, with your question. It's an interesting question about theater, even. Yes. Didactic theater, which this is. We set out, it's almost documentary in its style, in its feeling. I'm sure that you all were not surprised to find out that the Debut story was based on real, reality story. What is the responsibility of a theater artist who has asked all these questions and gotten you all riled up to provide you with an answer? Now, you know, Brecht, who's probably the greatest didactic writer in the Western world anyway, didactic playwright, always floundered with that too. People would say to him, you raise the questions, you make me think, and you don't give me an answer. And I don't know. Part of the reason we don't give an answer is because we really don't have certainly an easy answer. It would be trite. It would be not real. After all this really real study of asking the question, it would be unreal of us to say, and here's how you fix it up, folks.
I leave the play upset, not because I think it's the responsibility of the theater company or the writer to solve. What the wonderful consciousness raising in that play is that it seems to me you show this sort of multifaceted, all kinds of sexual abuse and battering and defining female sexuality in limiting ways, etc. And the answer to that, I don't think, is decriminalization. Obviously, no. That would be absurd to say that would solve all of the problems. Mm-hmm. And I'm also left uneasy, though, with if everyone just loves everyone, because I think there are economic and political and social, and I don't think any of us have an answer to how this revolution, really, of gender organization is going to come about.
I took another more personal message from the play, because I have a 10-year-old daughter. And the image of the mother and daughter embracing in the end was very powerful and very personal to me. And I recalled some conversations that Martha and I had a while back about, well, reminiscing about our own childhood and what we learned about our sexuality and what we learned not to do, how we learned to think what our sexuality was bad, and then what ways were appropriate to express it and what ways were inappropriate. And I've been thinking a great deal, because my daughter is close to adolescence, about what I can convey to her, in addition to what I already have, about what the life she's entering into, the phase of her life that she's going to be initiated into in all kinds of ways. And what I can tell her, what I can express to her of what I know now, that will be different from the way I was raised and what I was told or not told, that may help her deal with these things better than I have, more comfortably, and give her greater assurance and more confidence in herself.
Mimi, that's one of the issues that's really facing us with the juvenile prostitute in our society right now. The issue is, you have the right to do with your body, sexual liberation. And now, I'm running into 11, 12, and 13-year-olds, an 11-year-old child who's had sex with 11 boys and who's wondering why it isn't feeling great or why she's feeling bad about herself. Or mothers who are saying, well, if you have feelings, it's all right to have your boyfriend up in your room at 13. And because it's sexual liberation time.
A lot of us have wondered who this alleged 1960s sexual liberation, what that revolution was about and in whose interest, because it reminded me in the play again of the birth control pill and a lot of the wonderful things about what does that really do for women.
Thank you. The great advantage of the contraceptive pill is that it puts no limit on the number of sexual encounters one can have.
Then this one night when Ma and Duke were out, Candy and Angel, they took some drugs and passed
Another
out.
Another difference between the them and me is that I don't use drugs.
Oh,
I do take the birth control pill, and I do worry about it. My blood pressure's a little high, but, my God, I figure it's an occupational hazard. I mean, no job is entirely without risks. The President of the United States has hemorrhoids.
Make it with the both of us, you know.
Mimi, I'd like to bring you into the discussion. Mimi Golke, you are a literary critic, and your perspective on the kinds of myths that exist around the prostitute is something that we're very interested in adding to the discussion. And I'd like to ask all of you, what do you see now as the myths that we live with surrounding the prostitute?
Well, one of the things that I have been thinking about through my own field, which is the Renaissance, and I teach a great deal of Shakespeare, which I like to do, but in the last few years I've begun to notice how significant the image of the prostitute is in Shakespeare's plays, and how often, in fact, when a woman is being called a prostitute, she hasn't done anything that could remotely be described in terms of prostitution. In fact, if you take a play like Othello, when Othello accuses Desdemona of being not only unfaithful, but was sleeping with countless men, of course she's innocent in a technical sense. She is faithful, she is chaste. So the question that has come up in my mind is, why is this such a consistent theme in these plays, and what does it mean in terms of how the man is responding to the woman? Calling a woman a prostitute, in these plays at least, is a way for the man to exercise some control over the woman and to protect his own emotions or his vulnerability. Because I think what happens is that when the men feel close to the women in one way or another, and sexuality is the area in which they are most vulnerable, then I think they begin to feel that the woman has the power to hurt, basically. And so they need some way of defending against that, and raging against the women, accusing them of things they haven't done, and then in some cases actually killing them, is a drastic defensive measure. One of the other things I've thought about is, of course, in reading these plays and thinking along these lines, is how little I know about how the women feel and how they see themselves and their roles. Often in these plays, the women fade out. They don't really talk much. They don't express their own needs. We don't have the way they see their own sexuality, and it probably makes sense that that's the case, and that it's a man who's writing and maybe he simply doesn't know. This problem, I think, is reflected in maybe historical ways, in that I was reading a very recent book which touches on this subject, and it seems to me it's a recent subject for historians to be concerned with. The book is called Marriage, Sex, and the Family in England, 1500 to 1800, and it's by a man named Lawrence Stone. When he gets to the section on sexuality, what he has to do is go to about three documents, and there are only really three that he can point to, and they are all written by men. And of course, there are terrible problems of generalization from three or four documents, and of course, even what he is able to say about them doesn't tell us how women were perceiving their own lives and their own sexuality in this period.
Yes, well, why is that? Why don't we have more documents?
Actually, I think we're discovering that there are more sources than we thought, but they've been hidden, they've been, there are all those problems that women didn't consider themselves important enough or historic to write things down, to record them, to pass them on. But they did more than we think. They did a lot more than we think. They told each other. They wrote diaries. They wrote letters. And a lot of that exists, but it either isn't available. It isn't, nobody ever put it in a library and took care of it. Or it's there, but it's got the label John Smith Family Papers or something like that, so that we don't have easy access. And what we're having to do is discover and new methodologies. First, there's the search of the archives, but there's also things like oral history, which this play already has made wonderful use of. By going to women now, we can't go to women 300 years ago, but we can go to women now. and find out for ourselves more.
Martha Bosing, that's a good place to bring you into the discussion, because a lot of the work of getting this play ready involved just the kind of thing that Sarah Evans was talking about. What can you tell us about the things that the women in the theater had to do in order to create the characters and to create this play?
First of all, we met with and talked with the Pride women. Pride is an organization of people who want to affect change in prostitution. Women who have been involved in prostitution, and people from the community also who form a support group for women who want to get out of it and out of the life. And we've talked with these women. They were wonderful to us. They spent a great deal of time. We went to their homes. We talked with them there. They came to the theater. They watched run-throughs of the play. They corrected our language. They said, oh, no, she'd never do that. And, oh, she'd say this here. And we changed the play accordingly. They were just marvelous. And we even took some stories. One woman came and spent about 3 hours with us just telling us her life story. And in fact, that experience of our listening to her and to the enormous amount of abuse that she had come through became the basis of one of the stronger scenes in the play, the abuse story that some of you have mentioned. We also did our research by going down to Augie's, which is the local strip joint downtown on Hennepin Avenue. We went to the pornography films, mass of nine women walking into the Gopher on a Tuesday afternoon. And we went down to Schindler's and bought the plastic wrapped up books on bondage, which became the source of an image in the play when the women are all in jail. We took that, the bondage pictures right from the magazines from that. The woman who plays a stripper in the production became friends with a stripper and talked with her, got costume ideas from her. We deliberately got our costume ideas from Vogue magazine just to be contrary, just to deliberately show how alike they were. And it was amazing, the research we did on fashion magazines, the number of women in belts and metal breastplates that looked just exactly like the cheap bondage magazines we had gotten down in the back rooms of Schindler's. So we did do a lot of that actual research. That was one thing that happened for us, is that we went out and educated ourselves in the street world. The other thing we did was we spent a lot of time working on our own feelings and going inside ourselves. We realized that we weren't going to be able to act at these women in any way. We had to get inside of these characters. But we realized to play these women, we were going to have to really get in touch with that inside of ourselves and feel it. And we devised an exercise, which was really a meditation, which became the source of a lot of our work, in which we try, during the exercise, we try to find our own sexual energy, the source of it in our body, and as a meditation. We locate that within our body. And then we would imagine what would happen to that energy. We try to image it, give it a color, give it a shape, give it a sound even. What would happen to this energy if it was socialized, if we did with it as we had been taught to do with it? And people doing the exercise, all of us doing the exercise, would begin to imagine that image changing, would begin to imagine it going through our body as we've been expected and trained to do with it. Then we would come back to the more neutral thing of just finding the source again, and we would try to imagine what it would feel like if we just let that energy fill ourselves for our own purposes, for our own selves, without any sense of putting it anywhere or any sense of doing something that we've been taught to do with it. What would happen then to the image and the sound and the color of it? Well, it was amazing what happened out of this exercise, because moving from a meditation, we began to, as a group in ensemble work, get up and walk around the room. We began to relate to each other in these two different conditions. The one where the energy had been socialized and what we had done with it as we've been trained, and the other where we were more free, we could do with it whatever we wanted to do. We finally called the first one the condition of the prostitute. Because indeed, some of the women would begin to get into stances, begin to act coy, seductive, come on, start doing little come-ons, leaning up against the wall. Other of the women, in reaction to that, would go around storming, hitting the wall, screaming out, I protest this, I protest this. One of the women, who is an older woman and a wife and a mother, started running around taking care of everybody in this condition. How do you feel today? Are you okay? It was amazing to discover that, of course, that's what we did with our sexual energy. The other condition, which we began to call the condition of the spinster, Because invariably, in the second condition where we were allowing ourselves to do what we wanted with this energy, we would begin to move in circular, fluid movement. It was amazing to watch how this happened, quite organically, that the women would begin to move in circles. Even women who were sort of more closed off would, and down maybe, or internalizing this a lot, would move on the floor in circular patterns, begin somersaulting, begin moving around. And the women who came together would often spin together in some form, almost like I was reminded, looking at it from the outside, of the Sufis, of that kind of movement, that spinning circular motion that happens. So I said, oh, this is why they call women who own their own sexuality or don't give it away spinsters. And we were delighted to make that discovery.
Nothing to do with unpaid labor at the spindle.
Nothing at all. Nothing whatsoever to do with it.
Mimi and Martha Roth and Martha Bosing, I'd like to ask, what are the myths of female sexuality which you see explored in the life?
Well, we did talk deliberately at the beginning of this that we would like to kind of tap those archetypes that are given to prostitutes and therefore to women's sexuality in general. The obvious one that I think was really successful in the play is the prostitute with a heart of gold that was in the form of Nella, the old warm prostitute that you all love. Everybody in the audience always loves Nella. They feel like she's grounded, she's not going to hurt anybody. And she seems real archetypical to me in that we certainly see her in the movies all the time. That kind of prostitute. The, another clear one is the juvenile, the nymphette. Mm-hmm. You know, oh, in literature you find her all the time, that attractive nymphette image. So we did try to find these different types, the stripper who's hard and cold and, you know, mm-hmm. that kind of hard cold. And then the career woman, the very sophisticated woman who's in control, who runs her own business, that sense of real power. The junkie who's just absolutely down and out. We tried to carry them to their extremes, to their archetypical extremes, and then create real characters out of them once we were there.
But when he'd come around, he'd be really ripped and wanting to fool with us, and if Ma was there, he'd hit her too. I remember he knocked out a couple of her teeth once.
I was in high school, waitressing over at the Silver Oasis Cafe working nights, and I really wanted to finish school. But I had these older brothers, real assholes, you know, always making me do stuff for them.
She's old enough to
be. Hey, Nella!
She's old enough to.
Where's my clean socks?
Rubber tits.
Stuff like that, you know.
Oh, and I got
my mother said I let him on.
I didn't tell anybody because I didn't.
Nella, you lead them boys on. She said.
So I
anyway,
told her, I told Lisa.
I was waitressing over at the Silver
Roll,
and a
told
lot
me what
of
do.
Truckers came
she
in at
showed
night.
Me about tampons
get around,
and stuff
you
like
know?
That. Show me
I was pretty,
them.
I guess, and young.
This one night.
And they offered
Ma,
me money. They say
Ma
things
caught,
like, hey,
Lewis messing around
5 minutes in the cab
Darren
of my truck, baby.
Was yelling and trying
or,
to bite him. And
come on, come on,
Lewis
give me just a little piece.
Him and threatening
I need
him
it
with
real
knife.
Bad.
We
you
were
will
all
never miss
to be
it.
Except for
they called me
he
sweetheart.
Was crying and screaming.
Gorgeous.
He was real upset.
They'd say things
well,
like,
Ma called the police.
Hey, you ever had a loving
come.
Man?
When they
or
came,
$15 for 5 minutes in paradise.
It was just a domestic quarrel.
Well, you know,
she was married to Lewis,
I thought if I could save enough money,
could
I could
do,
get away from home and them
Lewis,
ever-loving
they
brothers.
They
were making me do it for free anyway.
And,
so I started going with the truckers and the cabs of their
he
trucks.
Passed out on the couch.
You know, some of them cabs are all blue inside,
and that's why
deep
we call
blue with stars. All sparkly.
And so when they left,
stereo speakers all around like in another world.
We went down to the hospital.
You know, I
kind of
liked it. And it was
down,
easy money.
He had to get
some and I got fired from my waitress job. But I met this guy, Victor.
And then we came
he's the one that really turned me out. That's how
sleeping.
I got into
they
the life.
Think they gave him some drugs or something.
I'd like to get back to Sarah Evans's point earlier about the definition of women as non-sexual beings, as not having sexual needs, as applying only to the bourgeois or upper bourgeois woman, and implying a reservoir of women who either do have sexual needs or who service men's, since the upper class woman doesn't. Because that is, it seems to me, is mostly what traditionally men do with their notion of female sexual needs, is say, well, you know, there is this class of women and they have them and they're uncontrollable like ours, but, you know, isn't it nice that there's a whole bunch of them that we can go and pay? And that, I don't know quite how that relates to all the stereotypes that you've mentioned, the individual ones, but I know it does somehow.
Yeah, Janet is just asking a question here about whether these are really archetypes of prostitutes or whether they're archetypes of women in general. Huh. And one thing that I always hope that we can do in the theater with an art form is that if you push the archetype to its extreme, it'll kind of come out the other side and touch everybody. And therefore, that is what we finally pick up. If we try to not use the archetype or not use the stereotypical one, but come into a very personal kind of individualistic thing, then I watching it can say, oh, well, that's what she's like. I'm not like that. But if you really push it to the outside, to that archetypical kind of caricature, there's the hope that then we'll recognize ourselves as one of those types right away.
It seems to me also always true in any stereotype of one group, one subgroup of us, that stereotype has to mean all of us, mm-hmm. in a sense, even if only in the negative, not that.
Yes.
And so whenever you have the good woman and the bad woman, they are tied together. You can't have the one without the other. You can't have the virgin without the whore. So that by pushing it the way you did, you sort of broke through, I think, in part to that.
The reason I asked that question is that when you said what the archetypes were, it didn't take a great leap to say, gee, isn't that funny? We can describe women faculty members, for example, where there is the warm, nurturing advisor type. There's the queen bee type, who is all profession. I mean, and there are the nymphettes. It just goes on, and I'm sure in any other profession, you could do, as long as you've got an array of women there. And I think the interesting thing is that there probably are no more options than five or six basic ones.
What they all do, it seems to me, one of the functions of a stereotype or an archetype is to depersonalize, so you don't see whoever is occupying that role as human.
So our attempt as women artists was to pick up those archetypes and those stereotypes, which I think are male, you know, pretty much established through the male literature and through the history of, you know, the way, as you talked earlier, the male view of women, to pick them up and then personalize them. So we have to see ourselves somehow. We have to go, have that relationship go on with us and with that character.
Well, Martha Bosing and any of the rest of you, but I'd like to ask this of you as the director. What difference do you think it makes, then, that it was a women's theater that created this play and that did the kinds of things that Mimi is describing?
To begin with, we started with our real feelings. Every rehearsal was begun with what we call a feeling circle, in which we sat and shared what we were really feeling about the work, about each other, about what was going on, and tried to bring those feelings into the work. Traditionally, in a male theater, one is asked to leave your feelings at the door. It's unprofessional to bring your garbage with you, is how it would be put. So we tried to use the garbage, what was coming up for us in relation to working on this play about our own sexuality, and bring it into the work. If we were angry, we'd try to work on the anger that day. If we were sad, we'd bring that in, whatever feelings were happening. So the attempt was to really personalize, to become these characters, to bring ourselves to them. And in fact, the characters were created with Martha Roth writing as we went, so that she came in first with the characters. We started creating and improvising them. Martha would go home, write scenes around them, bring them in. We'd discuss them, we'd throw out scenes, take up new scenes. So that the feeding was very back and forth. The people who created the characters that Martha would then write for, in part. It was a real mutual experience. So that the integration between life and work was very high, and I think unusual. Any theater I've worked in, that has not been the case. It's, in fact, considered unprofessional, as I say. What you have to do is separate yourself and bring yourself neutral to the work is the goal in most theater. I think also it's interesting that the key to the ensemble work was relationship, and the key finally to the play and to the solution, if it's as much as there is one, is relationship, which I think is traditionally a woman's issue. It's a woman's, you know, women do that in their homes. They're in charge of that whole area of life.
Yeah, our relationships became a major focus of the play, and it was relationships among women and women caring about each other at the end. And the way it began and the way it ended seemed to me, I don't know, I was thinking of the beginning as sort of, not the opening scene, but the abuse scene. Sort of a cacophony of stories, of horrors, and people not talking to each other at all. telling these stories out into, you know, the audience, but just out.
Ruth, she had a lot of boyfriends. She dated a lot. And then she told me she was turning tricks, and she said it beat waitressing or working in a store.
Sometimes it does.
So I tried.
But there
it
are
out.
Times that I'd rather be a waitress.
Than I was living with this
I've done some
guy.
Ice fishing weekends that were
pimp,
a
guess,
hell of a lot like work.
We were really
stinking
in love.
Fish houses.
It's pretty nice.
Full
to
of
me
raw
most of the
fish,
time.
Lit cigars, and a bunch of drunken pig farmers
stupid.
Who want to talk dirty and watch each other screw.
One time I remember I was out to this one place where they called me from, and there was a message on the tape. I got the numbers mixed up in my head, so I wasted the whole afternoon going to the wrong address. Well, he was so mad, he really beat me up. He picked me up and threw me down and threw me down. Threw me against this wall. I had a miscarriage. See, I was pregnant.
I have
pregnant,
been in love
only...
with every man I ever lived with. And I've been pregnant so
been
many
his.
Times.
I give the John's
so many chances, and I never
and
had a kid.
I
mean, I've got
know,
a couple of kids, but
ripped, you know,
they don't like me.
It. And this one night, about 3 a.m, I didn't feel like working anymore. So I told him I was going to sleep, only he didn't like that, and he pistol-whipped me again with those guns of his.
Yeah,
so I put some
my
stuff
old man, he's got two guns, too.
He went down to
says
the bar,
he needs them in case
out,
one of them doesn't go off, you know?
Only the
he's
taxi
real scared
the
of
bar.
That his gun
he
won't
ran
go off.
And shot the taxi's tires.
And then Huey, he was the biggest.
Back home
he took me and he threw me down on his back.
These people live like animals.
The
there was a show. Kind of women who are going
that
to end up.
Jimmy
had
rocket
cigars.
They were hard to take. They were very hard to take, and nobody was responding to anybody. And I was trying to listen with both ears at once so I could get them all, and I couldn't. And then at the end, it's a very different, you could think of the end as a kind of cacophony too, because it's the sound montage, but it works. I mean, the sounds become a part of each other and they echo each other, and somehow, although there are no words in it, the people on the stage are much more together.
One of the powerful things about this is feminist theater as opposed to what if the Guthrie decided to do a play on prostitution. Right at the beginning of the play, when the actors are out among the audience in character, and I began to feel myself uneasy with being in feminist theater and watching people I knew were feminist, very easily, what appeared to me to be very easily sort of playing these roles. I mean, they seemed terribly authentic to me. And I was also struck by the scene that Mimi refers to of this sort of process, and I think it's in all women right now, of on the one hand playing out the archetypes and the stereotypes, and on the other hand having an inner story that's screaming out of us. And I think that's part of the women's movement and consciousness raising in general, that we're sort of all in two places at once.
In everything I ever read, and I was obsessed with reading about sex, just as you were, when it came to the main event, the thing itself, there was an emptiness at the center. A knot, a zero at the bone. And you know what? That hole in the center was me. Oh, I figured out what that means. It means they get to screw you, but you don't be there.
I don't know where I am, but I'm sure not there.
Sometimes when I'm all alone, I have no dates, my phone doesn't ring, I wonder, is anybody here?
I'm sure not there.
Where am I? Swinging on a banana tree.
Where am I? Crawling the walls.
Where am I?
Inside me, crying for my mother.
It's a jungle in there.
You don't know what's in there.
Something could get lost in there.
It's you.
It's not you.
It's inside you.
It's everywhere.
No one knows what's down there.
Having seen the play from the balcony, I felt very much a part of it. I sat up there with Nell and a few of the other people. Some of the words were my words. Some of the thoughts seemed to be thoughts right out of me and out of my past. Because I dealt with a good deal of that, I could sit through the major part of the play and find myself involved, but yet looking from the outside in. When I had to turn around and look at the two women who are also members of Pride, who are at different points in their lives, and see their faces and the struggles they were going through just sitting there, and knowing the transitions that I've come through in 5 years of working as being a prostitute, my God, you know, society just has to know that it's going to take a long time. We've got the material in our guts. We've never been able to tap prostitutes before because you could never talk about it before. Ever. Mm-hmm. And now we've got a few guts that are opening up and can come and say yes. And we have women who are saying, okay, it's all right that you've been a prostitute. So have I been in some way. I'd like to eliminate the word from our vocabulary.
Prostitution and Women's Sexuality. How did we get into the life? A program addressing issues surrounding prostitution and women's sexuality in contemporary American society was produced with the help of a grant from the Minnesota Humanities Commission.